certainly appreciate the opportunity to learn a couple of new songs, perhaps, even if it wasn't the intent. I think we'll find, perhaps, that even the message that Brother Earl tried so earnestly to get across to us, the message of those songs will fit in very nicely, I hope, with the lesson that we're going to talk about tonight. I appreciate also the opportunity to get to speak to you tonight. I hope that as we've learned a couple new songs, that perhaps we'll learn a few things about God's Word that perhaps we weren't as familiar with as we were before. Very often, we oftentimes feel that we live in a really wicked period of time, and I don't think any of us would dispute that. And often it seems, as we live in a world like this for year after year after year, it seems like things get worse and worse the longer we live, as if though perhaps we're living in what could be the most immoral, the most wicked, the most godless period of time, certainly in our country, maybe ever in the whole period of world history, when it really starts to bother us. And that can present a lot of challenges to those who are trying to live a moral, faithful, righteous life before the Lord. And it can cause us great difficulty, great frustration in trying to live that way when all the world around us is wicked. And when it seems like it's been a really long time since God has ever done anything about it. You don't see God punishing people for their wickedness in overt sorts of ways. Brother Martin talked this morning about revenge and how we oftentimes want to see a sort of instant punishment for people, like with Korah when the ground opened up and swallowed him right there on the spot. We don't see God acting like that, and that can be very difficult for us to deal with year after year after year, trying to be righteous in a wicked world. Well, of course, those of us who studied history know that the world has been wicked for a long time. It's not a new sort of thing to observe among people. And in fact, there lived a man about 2,600 years ago in the southern kingdom of Judah, near the end of the existence of that kingdom, really, who lived in a similar society that was full of wickedness. And he, like us, was trying to live righteously and be pleasing before God. And he, like us, had a lot of problems, a lot of questions, a lot of frustrations that he faced and wanted answers for from his God. And he had a unique opportunity, perhaps, though, to speak to God directly with his questions and to get an answer back to some of the problems that he had. The man that I'm talking about was the prophet Habakkuk. And if you'll get your Bibles and turn to the Old Testament and look up the writing of this minor prophet, we have recorded by him his conversation with God. It's unique, perhaps, among all the books of prophecy in that the entire book, short as it is constructed as a question and answer session with God. He comes to God with some problems, some questions, some things that are troubling him, and he asks for answers, and God gives them to us. And I think the message that God gives to Habakkuk applies as well to us in our society as it did to Habakkuk where he lived. As we said, Habakkuk lived during a period in the history of Judah that was just before the very end. Without reiterating the whole history, you'll remember that after the kingdom split into the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, things began to go downhill. While David had been a strong king, and Solomon perhaps after him, and for the most part, people served the Lord during that time, the people in both kingdoms, north and south, began to adopt idolatry, and they grew further and further away from God. And with the idolatry came various immoral practices that were involved in idol worship. And along with that came just general disregard for the teachings of God about justice and about morality and about how to treat your brother. And it just got worse and worse. So much so that the northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrians at God's behest, really. God judged the northern kingdom in about 722. And then, about 100 years later, the same fate was about to befall Judah. And that's when Habakkuk lived. And in fact, depending on when you date this book, he lived right before this judgment of God was about to take place, like within just a couple of years maybe. But of course, he didn't know that yet. All he had seen his whole life was an entire nation of people, supposedly God's people, who had been wicked, and who had been immoral, and weren't treating each other right, and here he was, trying to be a servant of God, and just having a real tough time dealing with what he saw. If we look at the first part of the book of Habakkuk, he begins with a question. Look with me, chapter 1, starting with verse 2. He cries out to the Lord, "How long, O Lord, will I call for help, and thou wilt not hear? I cry out to thee, violence, yet thou dost not save. Why dost thou make me see iniquity, and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me, strife exists, and contention arises. Therefore the law is ignored, and justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous, therefore justice comes out perverted. There are two things that trouble Habakkuk about this. One, of course, is just the wickedness that he sees around him. Everywhere he turns, people are not living the way God would have them to do. There's injustice, there's violence, there's wickedness, immorality, and we know from the history of the period that this was a very dark time in the history of God's people. Shortly before Habakkuk lived, the king Manasseh had reigned for a very long period of time. It was 55 years. I didn't look it up. But a long time he reigned. And he was one of the worst kings ever. They worshipped all sorts of idols involving human sacrifice. They would sacrifice their children. All sorts of immorality were involved in the worship. And even though Josiah, who came after him, had tried to clean up the people's act, the hearts of the people were so far removed from God that there was really no hope of them turning back. In fact, another prophet, contemporaneous with Habakkuk, makes it clear that God's decision to judge the nation and punish them was pretty much a done deal. That even if they decided, little groups of people, to try to turn back to the Lord, the best they could hope for was that they might be spared in some way from the judgment that was to come upon the nation. So things had gone very, very bad, and Habakkuk was troubled by all this wickedness that he had seen surrounding him. But more than that, he was troubled by the fact that God apparently wasn't doing anything about it. He understood a good bit about God, as we'll see as we read a little bit further. God is a just God. God cannot tolerate sin. God cannot tolerate unrighteousness. God punishes the wicked and rewards the righteous. These are things we all know about God, and yet for hundreds of years, God's people have been disobeying him in the most flagrant sorts of ways, and it doesn't look like God was doing anything about it. And this, more than anything else, seems to be troubling him. Why don't you do anything, God? These people are so wicked. They're crying out for you to punish them in some sort of way, to show that their actions are immoral. So he was confused by this apparent contradiction. God had said, and the promises that he had made, the threats that God had made earlier in the history of the people, that if you ever stray away from me, I'll punish you in some sort of way. This was difficult for Habakkuk to understand. Why was God not doing anything when everyone around him was so wicked? Well, there are a couple of things we can learn about Habakkuk's approach to God right here. I think Habakkuk's character is one that we should try to emulate. And Habakkuk certainly was in a situation much like we are. Someone trying to be a righteous person in the face of a wicked world. One of the lessons that we should learn from this is that sin really ought to bother us. We see it really seemed to get under Habakkuk's skin, that he saw all this stuff going around. It made him very uncomfortable. It made him angry. It made him upset. It was something that caused him a great deal of pain. We read in the New Testament of other people that had similar sorts of problems, although this particular reference is to another Old Testament character. Peter writes in his second epistle, chapter 2, and verse 7, describes the character Lot. Talking about God, he says, "If he, God, rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, Lot, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds, then God knows how to rescue the godly from temptation." It's a long sentence, and what we really want to highlight is the fact that Lot here, who is trying to be righteous, living in a place like Sodom, surrounded by wicked people, it says that his soul was tormented day after day with their lawless deeds. He was oppressed by the sensual conduct of unrighteous men. We live in a society that has grown increasingly wicked and increasingly tolerant of sin. There's very little sense of public shame anymore about just about anything someone could do. The recent troubles that our president has undergone that have been so well publicized should be very disturbing to us, the kinds of conduct that he would apparently engage in and approve of. And perhaps what is just as disturbing is the fact that that kind of conduct can be described so publicly, so openly, throughout our entire nation and consume so much of our national attention. When you see all the messages that are contained in the media about glorifying different sorts of wicked things, when we see people that we work with and their moral habits and the conduct they engage in day after day after day, and no one seems to care anymore about what God says about what's right and wrong, and you live with these people and you have to work with these people, it can kind of harden you to being really upset about sin. I know in my own life, when I was much younger, when I was in college and just coming to Atlanta, the big city, from a relatively small town, and going to a school like Georgia Tech, and there were a lot of things that went on there that really bothered me when people would do certain things. People would smoke, or people would drink, or people would go to certain parties where I knew there were all sorts of immoral things going on, and I didn't like being around that. It bothered me. It made me feel uncomfortable to see that sort of thing going on. And then I entered the workplace, and well, if you ever worked in a job, you know that very often people in the workplace can be very worldly, very wicked in the things that they say, the language that they use, and it ought to bother us. And it used to bother me more than it does now. Having to find a way to live in a world like that, I seem to have just inevitably become less offended by certain things, less shocked by certain things, less upset by certain things. So you see it all the time, you hear it all the time, you're exposed to it all the time. It just doesn't bother me as much as it once did. And I think that's a problem. There's a danger in doing that. When Christians who are trying to stand up for what's right live in a world and try to kind of get by in a world that is not righteous, that is full of so much sin and iniquity and so much public acceptance of that sort of thing, then we can easily grow desensitized to that sort of thing. And once we allow that influence to have that effect on us, then, of course, that makes us more vulnerable to participating in the sin itself. If it's no longer something that seems so shocking, no longer something that carries the stigma or public shame anymore, then it's easy for us to kind of slide into participating in that sort of thing if we're not careful. But at the very least, even if we succeed in not actually participating in these sorts of things, our attitude toward it can change us, that we're never really bothered by the fact that people are sinning all around us. We need to strive to be more like Habakkuk in this way, more upset about the things that we see going on around us that are wicked. We have to adopt the kind of view towards sin that God has in order to be properly prepared to deal with it, to confront it, and to avoid it as we ought to do it. Well, even if we have that kind of outrage, say, over the sin that we have with us, we can still feel the same sort of way that Habakkuk does here, that why doesn't God do anything about it? Why is God silent? Why has God not intervened somehow to punish those that are wicked and prevent some of this stuff from going on and to punish those that have been guilty of it? Well, you have an answer for Habakkuk that begins in verse 5 of chapter 1 and goes through the end of the chapter, and basically his answer is, don't worry about it. I've got a plan to take care of all this. Verse 5, look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder, because I am doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs. And the chapter goes on to describe this group of people, this nation of people, and their great power and their fierceness and their thirst for conquest and power and their ability to go and just step over whoever they want to conquer whoever they might wish to use. Basically what God saying, my plan is I'm going to take the Babylonians over here, who up till recently when Habakkuk lived hadn't really been much of a world force. They were kind of on the rise. I'm going to take those people and they're going to be the ones to punish all these wicked people. They're going to come up against Judah, and as history later tells us, they begin to capture the people and take things away. They lay siege to the city on a number of occasions, and eventually they destroy the city of Jerusalem, burn the temple, cart up all the people and take them back to Babylon or send them off to other places, and the nation as it was is completely destroyed. This was God's answer to Habakkuk's problem. And furthermore, Habakkuk kind of lived in an interesting time, because this plan was something that was going to happen pretty soon. He tells him in verse 5, this is going to happen in your days. You will live to see this. And it may literally have been just a couple of years after Habakkuk wrote this prophecy that these things began to take place. It was going to happen very quickly. If you read some of the descriptions of these people, verse 8, he says their horses are swifter than leopards. The end of the verse, they fly like an eagle swooping down to devour. The last verse, 11, they will sweep through like the wind and pass on. Very quick, very powerful, very lightning sort of force. Before you realize it, out of nowhere, boom, there they are. They do their damage, and really, then they're gone. And furthermore, the plan is something that Habakkuk really would have a tough time accepting. Again, you know, the Babylonians were far away, and up until recently, they really weren't much of a military threat. And the idea that Babylon would come and destroy God's people, destroy Jerusalem, destroy the temple where the presence of God was, would seem a little bit far-fetched. But God says, I've got this plan. It's going to happen soon, going to happen quickly, and it's going to be pretty shocking. You will be astonished. You will wonder at the plan that God has in order to punish the wicked. Well, one of the messages we can get from God's answer to this is, God has a plan to punish the wicked. We're all pretty familiar with that. The New Testament talks about that in several places, one of which, for example, in 2 Thessalonians, a passage that I think we referenced from a sermon not long ago. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 6, it says, for after all, it is only just for God to repay with affliction those who afflict you, and to give relief to you who are afflicted and to us as well, when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, dealing out retribution to those who do not know God and to those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. These people that reject God, that reject the gospel, and in particular are persecuting you Christians who have obeyed God and who have accepted his gospel, they're going to get theirs when Jesus comes again. Eternal punishment, eternal destruction. These will pay, verse 9, the penalty of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power when he comes to be glorified in his saints on that day. We know about that. We've read about that, you know, since I was a little boy. I remember hearing that, you know, if you're wicked and if you don't obey God, God will ultimately send you to hell, and that will be it. But in day-to-day practice, that can kind of seem a little bit difficult to lean on, maybe, when we see all this wickedness going around. Again, as Martin kind of referred to this morning, we like to see those that do evil against us, or maybe those that do evil just in general, get punished and get dealt with appropriately, very quickly, right away. Instant incineration, as it were. But we know God has not promised us that. He's promised us that someday out there, when the end of time comes and Jesus comes again, all those that are wicked and have abused you and have been so flagrantly disobeying God, they will get what's coming to them. So even though we can see that pretty clearly, it sometimes is difficult to see in day-to-day practice. But we can learn from Habakkuk that Habakkuk lived kind of as we do now. All this wickedness going on for so long, and it just doesn't seem like God is doing anything about it. And that's kind of the way I tend to feel about the way things are now. Yet what Habakkuk didn't realize and couldn't see was God had a plan in motion. And while it seemed like it was taking forever for this to all come together, in fact, it would be executed before he realized what would happen. And the same is true with God's plan to punish the wicked. It may seem like it takes such a long time, and we may think, like Habakkuk does, that God is never going to follow through with his promises here to punish those that are wicked, but we can be confident that he will. So we need to be careful not to make the mistake that just because, well, everyone is sinning, everyone's involved in wickedness, there don't appear to be any really negative consequences about it, God doesn't appear to be doing anything to punish those that are being wicked, maybe I should just go with the flow, as it were, and be involved in those things as the rest of the world is. We need to be reminded, as God reminds Habakkuk here, that there's a plan. And when it comes, it's going to be something that's quick, something that will happen soon, even if it seems like it'll be a good while. And it will be come in such a way that will be astonishing to us when it actually comes to pass. Well, God reveals his plan to Habakkuk, and perhaps he took some comfort in the idea that, well, God is on the ball here. God is not completely ignoring what's going on down here. God does have a plan for dealing with the problem of wickedness that he sees here. But the plan itself seemed to raise some further problems for Habakkuk. He thought about this a little bit. And there are at least two problems, I think, that Habakkuk has with the plan that God had revealed of using the Babylonians to come and punish those here in Judah. And we get the second question beginning in verse 12 of chapter 1 and going down through the end of the chapter. In the first couple of verses, Habakkuk seems to point out that this plan of God seems to be a little bit confusing to him. This is not the way that Habakkuk might have thought about dealing with this problem himself. Read with me verse 12. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. Thou, O Lord, hast appointed them to judge, and Thou, O Rock, hast established them to correct. Thine eyes are too pure to approve evil, and thou canst not look on wickedness with favor. Why dost thou look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why art thou silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they?" Now, what he's talking about here is, let's review what we know about God. God is holy. God is just. God is pure. God can have nothing to do with evil. His eyes cannot look upon it. He cannot be associated with wickedness in any way, shape, or form. And yet, he's telling me here that his plan for punishing Judah, who, you know, admittedly were evil, but at least, you know, some of them there were trying to, you know, serve God in some sort of way. His plan for punishing them was to take this other nation, Babylon, who is way worse than anything that Judah had ever done. They read the description, and even God himself provides about how violent and cruel and vicious and worshiping their own power these people were. These people were far more godless, far more wicked than Judah was. How can God, you know, be consistent with his own nature, you know, and use these people to punish Judah? It just seemed real confusing to Habakkuk that God would go about this plan in his own way. I'm sure Habakkuk had his own idea about how this might work. Something more along the lines of the ground opening up and the wicked falling in, or something like that, or something more direct, or something, or some nation of very righteous, upstanding, godly people would come in, and they would be the ones to cart off Judah into captivity. So he was confused about how God could propose a plan like this, and didn't understand how God could reconcile that with his own character. So, in a very respectful way, he returns to God with this question, trying to help understand what it is that God has said. There's kind of another point. It's not as quite as clear, but I think there may be a thread of it in the rest of the chapter, beginning with verse 14. "Why hast thou made men like the fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, drag them away with their net, and gather them together in their fishing net. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they offer a sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their fishing net, because through these things their catch is large and their food is plentiful. Will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing?" The image here is of the whole world, basically, all men, all nations, and all those in Judah being like fish. Okay? Fish, generally speaking, don't have much organization as far as being able to mobilize a defense against, say, a fisherman like the Chaldeans. The Babylonians here are pictured as fishermen coming along with their nets, and they're going to go fishing. And what they do is capture everybody. And they worship these their fishing nets, the instruments, the ability that they have to do this. And the question Habakkuk is God going to let these people just run, you know, rampant across the whole world? Are they going to bring up all of the men? I mean, it's not just, you know, not just the wicked, but like everybody is going to be affected by what the Babylonians are going to do. Are they going to continually slay nations without sparing? Are they just going to be completely unleashed and destroy everyone and everything in their path? I think part of what perplexes Habakkuk a little bit about that, at least I know it would perplex me, is doesn't that seem to be just a little bit maybe unfair to people who maybe aren't worthy of this kind of punishment, perhaps? I mean, Habakkuk here, after all, is trying to serve God. He's trying to be righteous. He's trying to do what God wants him to do. And he really wants to see God punish those wicked people. You know, the guy across the street, and the guy who works with at the office, and maybe, you know, the king of the nation who's been so wicked. But he wasn't really expecting he himself to get harmed in any way by whatever punishment God had to offer to the nation. Is Babylon going to punish everyone, whether they're wicked or not? Perhaps Habakkuk realized that if Babylon came and laid siege to the city and carted everyone off, that he himself would have to suffer right along with all these wicked people that God was trying to punish. And that maybe seemed a little bit unfair to him. You know, I mean, God has done things in the past, like you think back maybe to the plagues during Egypt, where God made sure that the children of Israel were somehow spared from whatever the plague was that affected the land. And when the last plague came through, the angel of death went through the land and took the life of the firstborn. There was this elaborate process with the Passover to put the blood on the doorpost so that the Lord would pass over those houses that had followed his instructions, and they would be spared from the punishment from the plague, but the Egyptians would suffer. Maybe Habakkuk thought, I'm speculating a little bit here, but that would be a good way to go about doing it. Therefore, all these wicked people would get theirs, you know, but all the righteous people would be spared and would be delivered in some sort of way. What Habakkuk sees from this plan is everyone's going to be harmed in some sort of way, whether they're righteous or not, or wicked or not, when the Babylonians come to punish Judah. So he's confused about how God can use this plan, and he seems to think that maybe there's a little bit of unfairness involved with this plan. The first verse of chapter 2, though, rather than getting mad with God or upset with God, having presented his problems with God, he says, I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. He seems pretty confident here that he's missing something. Even though in his own wisdom, God doesn't seem to be doing quite the right thing here, he knows that that's probably just because he doesn't understand enough. So he's going to go to God with his problem and wait for God to reply and correct his thinking in some sort of way. And that's an attitude that we ought to have when we're faced with difficult problems. Well, one of the things that we can learn just from the nature of God's plan is that oftentimes God's plan for carrying out his will is going to seem confusing to us, and it's going to perhaps seem unfair to us at some time. Just some quick historical example that Habakkuk perhaps could already think about. Think about Israel, the nation just 100 years or so before this. They had been God's people, and yet God used this very wicked nation, the Assyrians, to come in and completely destroy them. Going back a little further, you think about David after he was selected to be the king. God had rejected Saul from being the king and selected young David to be the king. David rose to fame and popularity by slaying Goliath and delivering the nation from the Philistines. And yet, for a long period, perhaps a decade or more, David was forced to run around in the wilderness, being an outcast from the nation, being in constant pursuit by the king and his armies as he tried to kill David on numerous occasions. That doesn't seem right. If David were God's choice, it seems to be that God would find some way for Saul to just get out of the picture and David could just become the king and not have to go through all that difficult process. Going back further, you remember the story of Joseph, who was sold into slavery by his 11 brothers. He really hadn't done anything wrong other than perhaps provoking his brothers to be jealous of him, but he was sold into slavery and then later falsely accused and thrown into prison, and it may be hard to see how someone who was trying to serve God could face that kind of suffering. Of course, in the New Testament, the clearest example we have of how God's plan can seem confusing and even seem to be unfair is the life of Jesus himself. Here was God's own Son who had come here and lived a perfect life, purely innocent, totally guiltless of any sort of sin whatsoever, and yet it was God's plan for him to suffer and to die and be executed like a common criminal. It was very difficult for his disciples to understand that when Jesus was trying to explain it time and again, that this is what's going to happen to me and it's something that has to happen. They just could not understand why that would happen to be. And yet, that was God's plan. And even for Christians who follow Christ, it's clear that God has allowed all sorts of persecution throughout the centuries to follow those that try to serve Christ. Even though they're righteous, even though they're doing the right thing, very often they suffer in this life specifically because they're trying to do the right thing, as if though it's God's plan. So these things seem confusing to us. They don't seem fair. They don't seem right. How could God let things like that happen? This is the question that Habakkuk has for God. There are problems that we face even today that we can struggle with as Habakkuk did. People who try to serve God face the same sort of trials in their lives that other people do. People get sick, people die, people suffer from various natural disasters, hurricanes and floods and tornadoes, people have financial misfortune come into their life, people trying to serve God find themselves in positions where the wicked are able to prevail over us and take advantage of us in some sort of way. All when we're trying to serve God, and it can be very perplexing to try to understand how it is that God could permit this kind of turmoil in the lives of people who are trying to serve him. What possible good can come from it? How could God do that? Even though we have God's completed revelation, we often point to the fact that God has given us everything pertaining to life and godliness, and we understand so much more than people like Habakkuk did, because we have the whole picture. There are still things that happen to us in our lives that we just don't know the answers to. There are things that perplex us, things that cause us to wonder if God is fair, if God is just, things that confuse us about God. So we very often, even today in our own lives, face the same kind of perplexity that Habakkuk faced here in trying to understand what God was trying to accomplish. Well, we need the same thing to deal with those problems that Habakkuk did at this time. We first need to be willing to come to God with these problems and to seek an answer from Him, to see how He would correct our thinking, as it were, as Habakkuk says in chapter 2 and verse 1. And from God's second response here, we learn perhaps the key to understanding these things, or perhaps learning how to deal with these things. The first thing that God says, He says many things in chapter 2. The rest of chapter 2 is basically His response. And most of it deals with the fact that Babylon, this wicked nation that God was going to use to punish relatively righteous Judah, would ultimately get their punishment as well. God really had already said that in the last verse 11. At the end of verse 11 of chapter 1, He says, even though they're going to do all these things, they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. Perhaps Habakkuk missed that a little bit, but God goes into great detail, which we won't read here now, talking about all the sins and the wickedness of the Babylonians and how they would be punished ultimately for their sins. So God's going to make it right somehow. Even if it doesn't appear to be so immediately, God's plan ultimately will work out in such a way that the wicked will get what's coming to them and the righteous will ultimately be saved in some sort of way. You could go through all the examples we looked at. The Assyrians were conquered by the Assyrians, the wicked people, but the Assyrians themselves got conquered. In fact, by the Babylonians themselves. David was pursued by Saul for all those years, but it worked out because Saul eventually was killed in battle, or took his own life actually, and David became the king and was better off because of the experience that he had. Joseph's life, of course, worked out to the preservation of his family and the preservation of Israel, leading ultimately to God's long-term plan of bringing Christ into the world. And of course, Jesus, His suffering was an integral part of God's plan. He had to die in order to accomplish what He came here to do, to provide a way for us to be saved. It's difficult to understand that, particularly if you were living there at the time, but it's part of God's plan. And even our suffering today, while it seems unfair and while it seems unnecessary, can strengthen our faith, cause us to depend more on our God, cause us to draw closer to Him rather than on our own selves, and therefore make us stronger in the long run. The second part of God's answer here, not only that Babylon, God will ultimately take care of the Babylon problem if you just give Him enough time. The other part is, you just need to continue to trust in God no matter what happens. He says, verse 4, "Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith." And really what this is saying is the righteous will survive God's judgment, will persevere through his trust in God. Habakkuk, if you just trust me that everything is going to be all right, if you just continue to serve me and stay on my side, then no matter what happens when the Babylonians come, ultimately you will be preserved somehow, some way. And this was the lesson that Habakkuk had to learn. That's key, of course, to our own plan of salvation with regard to Christ and God. The Apostle Paul quotes this very verse in the book of Romans in introducing his outline of how we're justified by faith and not by works, by saying that the righteous will live by his faith. And it means much the same thing. We will be saved in judgment when God comes to judge all men, when God comes to judge those wicked people that we talked about earlier. We will be saved because we've trusted in the plan that God has put forth, in sending His Son to substitute for ourselves and giving His life and taking upon Himself the sin, the punishment for the sins that we've committed. Only by trusting in God's plan and trusting in His Son can we be saved, and no other way it is going to work. That will seem confusing to a lot of people, still today. How could God's Son dying somehow save me and make me righteous? It seemed unfair to other people. A lot of the Jews thought, well, God promised us this special place in our relationship to Him, and yet now anyone who has this faith can be saved. And Paul deals with that somewhat in Romans chapter 9. I've lived all my life a righteous life and tried to do the best I can, and yet here's this person who sinned all his life and then accepted Jesus toward the end, it seems like I've been more righteous than he has. All sorts of ways you can look at God's plan and think that it's not being fair to everyone. But having faith and trusting in God, what God's plan has presented, is key to our own salvation. And it's also the key to overcoming the apparent injustices that happen in our lives. When evil comes into our life, whether it's sickness or financial misfortune or other sorts of problems that seem to be almost at God's own direction, the key to overcoming that is being willing to trust in God and knowing that serving Him is always the right thing to do, no matter how difficult it becomes and no matter what terrible things may happen to us in our lives. That could be hard to accept, but when you look at Habakkuk's response to this, it's clear that his faith was stimulated by God's explanation of these things. In verse 2 of chapter 3, he says, "Lord, I have heard the report about thee." He's heard what God has had to say about these things. "And I fear. O Lord, revive thy work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy." He's calling for God to proceed with this plan that he has established for punishing Judah, but asking him in his wrath, as he carries this out, to remember mercy, to try to spare those that are trusting in him. And then in the interior part of the chapter, he discusses the great power of God and the purpose that God has had through the years in punishing the wicked and delivering the righteous. And then verse 16, Habakkuk realizes that he has to be prepared now for what is about to come. "I heard all the things that God had said, and my inward parts tremble. At the sound, my lips quiver. Decay enters my bones, and in my place I tremble, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us." Habakkuk has accepted the fact that God's going to punish Israel, and he's going to be caught right smack dab in the middle of it when it comes. I'm sorry, punish Judah. But he's willing to accept that. He's willing that no matter what happens, he will continue to serve God because it's the right thing to do, and count on God to save him in some way when this great distress comes. The final verses of his writing here shows the great faith that he has reached in his discussion with God. "Though the fig tree should not blossom, and there should be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk on my high places." No matter how bad it gets, if all his sources of food are completely taken away from him, he's not going to deny God. He's going to, in fact, rejoice in God, exult in the Lord, and be confident that God will rescue those that are trying to serve him. God sent this message to Habakkuk before all this took place. Habakkuk was living at a time when God was not yet punishing the people, but he was preparing to. And this whole conversation, this whole exercise of dealing with these issues, clearly helped Habakkuk build his faith, because he was going to need it when the time came for God to punish the people. And we need to have that same kind of faith in our lives. When things go well in our lives, it can be difficult to see such a need for this kind of great faith. But if we're going to survive, we need to have that faith. One day God may judge our nation. We talk about how wicked it is, how it seems to get worse and worse and worse. And we've seen through history that nations rise and nations fall. And if that were ever to happen to where we live, we would certainly need this kind of faith to continue to get by in our service to God. One day, God may permit some kind of tragedy to befall us, some unfortunate thing, some sickness, some death, some misfortune that seems unfair, seems to have no purpose, but it may happen. And when that happens, we need this kind of faith in order to be able to survive and get through. And of course, we know that one day, God will judge all of us with eternal consequences at stake. God has promised that we all will face judgment. Even if we're a Christian, even if we've been righteous, we will be judged. And it's at that time that we will need to have that faith in his plan. We will need to have lived our lives trusting that the sacrifice of Jesus will get us through that judgment and save us from the fate that befalls the wicked world that we survive in. One of the simple tests of that faith is whether we've obeyed those initial instructions that God has given us in His gospel. He doesn't ask for very much in terms of what we must do once we've come to believe the truth about His Son, once we've made that decision to repent, try to live our lives the way God would have us to do. He asks us to confess our belief in Him and to be baptized. It's a very simple thing, but if we don't have enough faith to do that, then we don't have the faith to survive the kinds of terrible judgments that could well befall us in our lifetimes. And if we're Christians and we're struggling with what it's like to live in a difficult world, then I challenge us to try to develop the kind of faith that Habakkuk has in resisting the sin that exists around us and renewing our faith in God and our commitment to try to serve Him. If we can help you in any way with any spiritual need that you may have, we encourage you now to come forward as we stand and sing.